Boeing says literally, "I'm sorry." We'll see how far that goes, huh? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, today the 29th day of October. Good as always to have you along, everybody. It may or may not have been planned this way, but Boeing CEO Dennis Muilenburg spent a couple hours sitting at a long green table in front of the Senate Commerce Committee today, 1 year to the day after the first of those two Boeing 737 MAX crashes. Natalie Kitchreff of The New York Times was at the hearing. Natalie, it's good to have you back on the program.
Thanks, Kai.
First things first, I saw a tweet of yours this morning as Mr. Muilenburg was heading into the hearing that his job was on the line. Do you think he saved it?
I think he performed pretty well, honestly, given the situation. Now, keep in mind, he faces two hearings this week. Tomorrow, he faces the House Transportation Committee. That's the committee that has been leading the investigation into the MAX. And that's expected to be the more adversarial of the two hearings.
That's really interesting, because today, I mean, there were moments of collegiality and common cause, but there was a whole lot of adversarial questioning as well, right, on these text messages and what Boeing knew when it knew it. Also, the idea of the FAA and how Boeing works with them to certify this plane.
That's right. I mean, what I would say covering this for the last several months, I think there was a lot of fear inside of the company about how he was going to handle this. He's not known to be a particularly comfortable public speaker, but he was able to navigate some of those tense moments. Tomorrow, you're going to see the committee that has really been digging into this documentation. These are folks that really know their stuff, supposedly. So we'll see what happens tomorrow. I mean, I do think there were moments of reckoning for the company and some really important admissions by the CEO today.
Do you think he convinced the senators, at least, and as you say, we'll see how he does tomorrow, do you think he convinced them that Boeing's mission is safety first, as he took pains to say, Mr. Muilenburg?
Well, I mean, it's unclear what they were convinced about. I think what he was able to say and what was, I think, really important for the company to get across is that they are committed to improvements. You've seen this company kind of have a level of confidence in the past where they haven't wanted to admit any error. And that comes from Muilenburg as well. This time around, he was a little more flexible on that. And I think that flexibility probably went over better than an approach of nothing to see here, we're not changing anything.
A word here about Boeing as a going concern, as it were, right? I mean, this company has tens of billions of dollars in backlogged orders. The 737 MAX will eventually, one imagines, fly again. So it's not like the company's at risk.
No, that's right. I mean, this is the biggest aircraft maker in the world in an industry where it's essentially a duopoly. Yeah. So no one should expect that Boeing is going anywhere. That being said, they have enormous brand risks to be managing right now. And this is the person at the helm of all of that. So whether he stays in his post, whether he's able to get the company through this, I think it's a big question. That doesn't mean the company's going anywhere, but the extent to which they can manage it, I mean, it's an open debate at this point.
Last thing, my first question was sounded and was tone deaf, right? Because first things first in this issue is not Mr. Muilenburg's job, but the 350 or so people who are dead because of the 737 MAX. I want you to tell me what happened as he was on his way out of the hearing and that I guess she's the mother of a victim stopped him.
That's right. And this was a really intense moment where Nadia Millerin, who's the mother of Samia Stumo, who died in the Ethiopian crash, confronted Mr. Muilenburg directly and said, "You need to look at people when you apologize to them." And he's on his way out. He spins around, looks her right in the eye and said, "I'm sorry." It was the first time that that's happened. Now, I understand he's meeting with the crash victims today, and so we'll address them, but it was a moment.
Natalie Kitchreff from The New York Times. She and the paper have been all over this story the past couple of months. Natalie, thanks a lot. Good to talk to you again.
Thank you, Kai.
Again, far, far from the most important thing about the hearing today, but Boeing investors seemed pleased with how things went. Shares up better than 2% today. Elsewhere in equities, not really so good. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We mentioned this yesterday at the top of the program that we are in the middle of a big week for corporate earnings, which means there is a word you are going to be hearing a lot.
Expectation. They say
the company beat expectations and it reported.
Most on the street were expecting them to earn just $1.31.
So for today's installment of Kai Explains, what expectations actually means and who decides what those expectations are.
Hey, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
You recently asked what's going on with this economy.
So how do these two concepts work together?
At the most basic level, we're talking about how companies are expected to perform come earnings time versus how they actually did perform. Caleb Silver is the editor-in-chief of Investopedia.
Performance refers to financial metrics like profit, sales, new customers, return on investments, and other data points that tell you how healthy a company actually is.
Take, for instance, McDonald's, which reported third quarter earnings last week. CNBC had the coverage.
The revenue line came in just about in line with expectations, $5.43 billion versus the $5.48 billion the street was anticipating. But again, it's a decent chunk of a miss.
In other words, McDonald's revenue in the third quarter was almost, but not quite, where Wall Street thought it ought to be. And by Wall Street here, we mean what are called sell-side analysts. Here's Sarah Williamson. She's the CEO of FCLT Global.
So analysts at the large investment banks.
Wells Fargo, JP Morgan, Citibank, you know the list.
Analyze a company, look at their strategy, and try to estimate or guesstimate what they might earn in an upcoming quarter.
And then they make public recommendations about a company's stock, whether to buy it, sell it, or hold it. There are 32 sell-side analysts who watch McDonald's, which is pretty normal for a big publicly traded company. They get their data, those analysts do, from two places. First of all, the companies themselves. Here's Stephanie Link. She's the head of global research at the investment firm Nuveen.
In the United States, there's a lot of disclosure from companies. They do conference calls with analysts. They do conferences, and they visit with investors as well as analysts that cover the companies.
And also,
a very good analyst will go out of their way and try to find non-traditional ways of being even more accurate.
Maybe calling the company's suppliers or actually getting out of the office entirely.
They might be doing a bus tour, which is just getting a whole bunch of investors on a bus and you drive to various different locations and you see the product in the store, you see the traffic in the store.
The end goal being?
You really just get any kind of information at all in order to get a feel for how the business trends are shaping up.
Then all of the analysts publish their analysis and earnings forecast, and those become expectations. It's not a science, to be clear, nor are expectations gospel. Again, Caleb Silver from Investopedia.
So when you hear about companies meeting or not beating expectations, you don't have to care too much about what's happening with individual companies. But if you hear, let's say, in the retail sector that a lot of companies are missing expectations, that means sales are weakening and that the consumer isn't spending as much, which is a bad sign for the economy.
Just re-upping the signs of the economy coming this week, apocalyptic or otherwise. The Federal Reserve meets on interest rates today and tomorrow. The announcement comes tomorrow. The Bureau of Labor Statistics delivers the October jobs report Friday morning. If you've got something you'd like to have explained, you got to tell us. That's the only way we know. Twitter's probably best. The show is at Marketplace. I'm at Kai Ryssdal, K-A-I-R-Y-S-S-D-A-L. My boss tells me I have to spell it out. Megan McCarty-Carino did a story for us a couple of weeks ago. You might remember it, the perils of texting and email punctuation in a multi-generational workplace. Periods and ellipses are apparently a problem area. That was the lighter side of a new reality for the American labor force. More people working longer, well past conventional retirement age. But there is a not-so-light side as well. Here's Megan.
Negative stereotypes about age are so common, we sometimes don't even give them a second thought. But in the ongoing drama of the presidential campaign, the issue of age has been pretty hard to ignore.
It's time to pass the torch.
When you take one look at me, my face is my message.
Are you forgetting what you said 2 minutes ago?
We need generational change.
While competition for the top job in the United States is uniquely cutthroat, those attitudes about age are pretty widespread.
It's just kind of the reality of the world that we live in.
67-year-old Thomas Epps found himself back in the job market a few years ago. He had a long career in public relations, heading up communications for major international companies. But he wasn't getting calls back. And when he finally interviewed with a hiring manager,
he, you know, with kind of a chuckle said, have you ever thought maybe it's time to just go smell the roses and enjoy life a little bit? You know, it was a very clear signal that I had aged out, that it was time for me to move on.
Writer Ashton Applewhite hears a lot of stories like that. Several years ago, she started a blog called Yo, Is This Ageist? A nod to a similarly named blog on racism. Readers submit anecdotes, and she weighs in on whether they're ageist. Spoiler alert, they usually are.
I think we are somewhat clueless talking about age, that ageism has gone pretty unexamined in the culture at large until now.
From job postings looking for young blood or digital natives to websites representing innovation with pictures of young people, she says subtle ageism is everywhere in the workplace, despite growing awareness of other forms of discrimination.
Would we talk about casual sexism, casual harassment, casual racism?
A 2018 AARP survey showed two-thirds of workers over 45 had witnessed or experienced ageism in their workplace, like older workers being passed over for promotions, laid off, or not hired. Yet few companies have formal programs to address the problem, says Gerda Govine-Ituarte, a diversity training consultant.
When it comes to ageism, that's sort of the last one on the bus. Even when there's training, a very small portion of the time is provided to deal with that specific topic, because I think it's one that most people don't consider to be very important.
A report from PwC showed while the majority of large companies have diversity and inclusion programs now, only 8% of them include age in their strategies. And that's bad for business, says Lori Trawinski with AARP.
When you have the benefit of different life experiences and perspectives, you often end up with better ideas and better products.
Her research shows age-diverse companies are more profitable and productive, especially when working on complex problem-solving tasks or those that require soft skills like emotional intelligence. She says there's a lot more employers can do to welcome older workers, like starting intergenerational mentorship programs, offering more flexible work arrangements, and improving recruiting.
If you have a landing page on your website that shows photos of only young people, it could be that an older person might not want to apply for the job.
After a year striking out in corporate America, Thomas Epps found luck in a different world where his age and experience were valued, academia.
You know, kind of found a first love when I got involved in the university environment, which is just a wonderful, wonderful place to be.
He's currently teaching reputation management at the University of Mississippi, proudly known by its nickname, Ole Miss. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Coming up.
And it just takes you in. You want to look and you think, oh, crikey, well, I wonder what that famous landmark in Milan is.
Enough Boeing news. We are going back to the early days of flying. But first, true or not, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's off 19 points today, less than a tenth percent, 27,071. The NASDAQ dropped 49 points, 0.6%, 8,276. The S&P 500 basically flat, off 2 points, 3,036 there. Xerox shares up 11% today after the company reported strong quarterly earnings. The fortunes of the online food delivery platform Grubhub are not as rosy. The company warned that its growth may slow because the customer, that is you, seems to be hopping between different food delivery apps depending on which one's offering the better deal. Grubhub stock swooned 43% today. GM reported better than expected. See what we did there? Expected? Expectations? Revenue and earnings lowered full-year outlook, though, after the strike. GM stock still up better than 4% today. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money.
I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. The corporate name in the news today, bankruptcy edition, is Murray Energy. It's a coal miner. Murray is the eighth coal company to seek the protection of the courts so far this year. Bob Murray, whose company it is very closely connected to President Trump. He has railed against what he calls the war on coal. In point of fact, though, in its legal filings today, the company began by blaming not government regulation, but rapidly deteriorating industry conditions. In other words, power plants are less interested in buying coal as cheaper energy sources outcompete it. Marketplace's Scott Tong has that story.
Murray Energy owns mines in Ohio, West Virginia, Alabama, and Kentucky. In its legal filing, the company said its power plant customers, quote, refuse to accept delivery of coal. That's how bad business is, when the electricity market prefers cheaper natural gas, and in some places, solar and wind.
This is pure market forces and capitalism at work.
That's law professor Patrick McGinley at West Virginia University. A decade ago, half of America's electricity came from coal. Now, 27%. The decline began with older, inefficient coal plants shutting down. Now, even the middle-aged ones are going, says Clark Williams Derry at the Institute for Energy Economics and Financial Analysis.
Even if you've got a newer power plant, better equipment, more things to help you comply with environmental laws, it still may be losing you money compared to turning to wind or solar or to gas.
Like its competitors, Murray plans to reorganize through bankruptcy and unload debt and other obligations. Cecil Roberts, president of the United Mine Workers of America, says in many cases, coal mining firms stop paying for their retirees' health care.
The same type situation has occurred over and over again, where retirees lose health care.
It's unclear how Murray Energy will emerge, but it says it's well-positioned for the future. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
The NCAA announced today it's going to begin the process of letting college athletes profit from their names, images, and likenesses. It's a big change for the famously pure NCAA vis-a-vis athletes and what they can do. Kimberly Mylock teaches sports management at Texas Women's University.
I think this is a direct response to the recent legislations that the different states have attempted to pass in which athletes can be compensated.
First among those states, California, where a new law will let college athletes here accept endorsement deals starting in 2023.
The sheer profits that the NCAA and its member institutions generate from college athletes, it's just become an issue where they absolutely have to do it now.
Two more things which come under the however comma tab. First of all, it's going to be a couple of years before any changes go into effect. The NCAA wants students to profit, quote, in a manner consistent with the collegiate model, so there is some leeway there. Also, this afternoon, after the NCAA's announcement, Senator Richard Burr, Republican of North Carolina, tweeted this, quote, if college athletes are going to make money off their likenesses while in school, their scholarships should be treated like income. I'll be introducing, the senator went on, legislation that subjects scholarships given to athletes who choose to, in quotes here, cash in to income taxes. So there is more to come on that story. In health news today, Walgreens, the drugstore chain, is going to close something like 150 of its in-store walk-in clinics, the ones it has been running itself, not profitably, it should be said. About 200 clinics that are connected with local health care providers will stay open. At the same time, Walgreens is going to add some Jenny Craig weight loss centers to some of its stores as well. Marketplace's Mario Segura explains the strategy here.
Did you know that you could get a blood test at some Walgreens or see a doctor or a dentist? Walgreens, like its competitors, CVS and Walmart, has been trying to turn itself into a sort of healthcare hub. Robert Huckman at Harvard Business School says for that to work,
they need a set of consumers who are willing to see that retail pharmacy is not simply a place they go for candy bars and deodorant and toothpaste, but a place where they might actually go to get healthcare and advice about how to improve their health.
We're not there yet. Huckman says the Walgreens clinics haven't performed that well.
And so what all these clinic models are now trying to do is to increase their presence and repeat interaction with customers.
This is where Jenny Craig comes in. Weight loss programs are something you wouldn't necessarily get at your doctor's office. Also, as Elizabeth Carpenter at the consulting firm Avalere Health points out, they require you to come in regularly.
You know, if you think about a clinic model, somebody may have strep throat once a year and decide to, you know, use an in-store clinic with something potentially like Jenny Craig. In theory, that engagement would be ongoing.
The idea is if Walgreens can get customers into stores every week to meet with a dietary consultant, get weighed, and come up with a meal plan, those people might get used to the idea of getting health and wellness services from a retail pharmacy. I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
We didn't plan for this to be an aviation-heavy program today, but sometimes you just got to roll with it, I guess. Totally different slice of flying, though, than Boeing. Back when airlines and the whole idea of commercial aviation was new and, yes, risky, those airlines would hire artists to create what can only be described as part transit map, part advertisement laying out their new routes. Many of those have been collected in a new book. It's called Airline Maps, A Century of Art and Design. Mark Ovenden is one of the authors. Mark, it's good to talk to you.
Thank you.
This seems like a sort of an existential question to ask right off the bat, but I found this book so interesting, first of all, for the graphics and the information, but also because these maps, I mean, they're just for show, right? It's not like anybody flying needs to consult them to figure out what stop to get off at.
Yeah, you can't really imagine anyone getting off a plane midway because they want to look at the ground beneath, can you really? It's not going to work like that. So imagine if you're doing, I don't know, the flight between Karachi and Cairo. Well, you know roughly it's going to go over a bit of the Arabian Sea and over the Suez Canal or whatever, but you don't really have to show the exact trajectory of the plane because you're not going to know, are you? You're going to be 35,000 feet in the air. So there's been this wonderful creativity that artists have had in making these incredible route maps for a century now.
I wonder how much it matters that this industry came of an age when advertising was really getting going and people actually understood the power of cartography and maps and advertising and graphics to sell a new product.
I just think that it must have been an amazing time to have been asked to draw a map for an airline. First of all, you've got this incredible new technology of these things flying about in the air that people could only dream of in the past. Then you were suddenly asked, hey, can you make a map that shows roughly where this plane is going to go to? And you're going to show all of the states of the West Coast of America or something, and you've got to do it pictorially. Use any style you want, make the thing look attractive, put the plane in as well if you can do. And that must have been a great challenge, mustn't it, if you were a commercial artist in the 20s and 30s. But then, probably in the 70s, it feels like no one's really making that much of an effort anymore. It's such a shame.
Well, but here's the thing, right? We can now look at a tiny screen in our hands and figure out where we want to go by a pull-down menu. Or even once we get on the plane, you've got like a 3D map practically on your seat back. And what do we even need, you know, these printed sort of advertising-y things for?
And I love those things on the back of the seat backs.
Yeah.
But don't you think we're missing something as well if we've stopped pre-designing a whole map of the world? I don't know if you spotted that map, which was based around Barcelona. It's got the name Barcelona in the middle. It's got these lovely little vignettes of what you're going to see in Venice or Frankfurt or Geneva. And it just takes you in. You want to look and you think, oh, crikey, well, I wonder what that famous landmark in Milan is, or what is that building in Granada? Oh, I really want to go there. So I think that they do still serve a purpose, you know. I think it's a real shame that designers are not using the modern tools to create some of the more beauties that we had in the classic times.
That one about Barcelona is on page 140 of a book called Airline Maps, A Century of Art and Design. It's absolutely fascinating, actually. A good trip through history. Mark Ovenden and Max Roberts wrote it. Mr. Ovenden, thanks for your time, sir. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Kai. All the best.
This final note on the way out today, in which had Boris Johnson just asked, we could have told him it was a bad idea. Apparently, Mr. Johnson, as you know, the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, was so sure he was going to be able to get Brexit done by, wait, what now? Oh, yes, the day after tomorrow, that he had thousands of 50 pence Brexit commemorative coins dated 31 October 2019 minted.
They are now, those coins, reports Bloomberg, being melted down. Two things. First of all, the House of Commons approved a December 12th general election today. Number two, the coins. Stamped on one side was peace, prosperity, and friendship with all nations. Originally, Theresa May's idea, by the way. And we are out of here. The Dow off 19 points today, less than a 10%. The NASDAQ down 49.6%. The S&P 500 basically flat. Our digital and on-demand team includes Carrie Barber, Samantha Fields, Joanne Griffith, Ben Hethcote, and Sarah Menendez. Sitar Nieves is our executive director of on-demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.